Peter B. Collins with news and comment. It is Tuesday, December 18th, 2012. You got about 20 minutes or so? I've got some news stories that I think you should pay attention to.
Give us 20 minutes and we'll give you the world. We bring good things to life.
Well, no GE or other corporate sponsors here. Just the news that I think is important today and worth you paying attention to. Daniel Ellsberg. Once known as the most dangerous man in America for his release of the Pentagon Papers, has announced the founding, he's co-founder, of the new Freedom of the Press Foundation. It's a response to the crackdown on WikiLeaks and the proven need for an antidote to the excessive secrecy that is endemic in the current media and government state that we live in. And this group has started out by providing tools to fund WikiLeaks, government transparency advocates, Muckrock News, military investigators at the National Security Archive, and general investigative journalism site called The Uptake. And there's a website up now at pressfreedomfoundation.org, and if you're so inclined, you can donate or otherwise sign up to support these efforts. Thank you, Daniel Ellsberg. He also is one of the plaintiffs in the suit that we've been talking with Carl Mayer about, challenging the National Defense Authorization Act and its draconian detention language. Well, the nation continues to grieve and try to sort out the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. And I'm going to post a link to this powerful article of commentary, a very personal piece written by a woman named Liza Long. And she closes it out by saying, "I am Adam Lanza's mother." And Liza Long is the mother of four children, a single mom. And one of her children is named Michael. And with brutal honesty, she describes how recently Michael has been acting out, threatening to kill himself, threatening to kill her. And she really makes a very powerful plea for help. She said, "I'm sharing this story because I am Adam Lanza's mother. I am Dylan Klebold's and Eric Harris's mothers. I am James Holmes' mother. I am Jared Loftner's mother. I am Seung Hui Cho's mother." That's the Virginia Tech shooter. "And these boys and their mothers need help. When I asked my son's social worker about my options, he said about the only thing I could do was to get Michael charged with a crime. If he's back in the system, they'll create a paper trail," he said. "That's the only way you're ever going to get anything done. No one will pay attention to you unless you've got charges." She said, "I don't believe my son belongs in jail. It would make things worse. But it seems if the U.S. is using prison as the solution of choice for mentally ill people. According to Human Rights Watch, the number of mentally ill inmates in the U.S. prison system quadrupled from 2000 to 2006, and it continues to rise." Another article I saw showed that states have cut nearly $2 billion in funding for mental health in the last 2 years alone. Will we learn? Will we address these issues and, you know, put aside the mania about raising taxes and take a hard look at what our society needs and then find the ways to fund it? We start off with the fundamental premise that all government is bad and all the funding should be cut. And we don't cut defense spending. We don't cut intelligence spending. The TSA is groping at airports, and oh, we'll get to that in a moment. But we've found it fairly easy to cut health care funding, particularly for mental health. The Canadian broadcasting company online at cbc.ca posted an article about misinformation coming out of the media coverage of the Newtown shootings. And on Sunday, the Connecticut State Police issued a warning saying that if people intentionally spread false information over social media, they could be prosecuted. Now, I don't defend anybody who posts completely fabricated information or poses as someone else. There are miscreants, devious people who will always game the system, whether it's writing a letter to the editor or posting something scurrilous on a newspaper website. But before we blame some people who put up information on Facebook or Twitter, let's talk about the corporate media and the way they were too willing to take uncorroborated information from Facebook or Twitter and put it on the news as fact. Now, the biggest blunder was mainstream media initially reported that the shooter was Ryan Lanza, the older brother of Adam Lanza. And because he has a Facebook page, they grabbed his picture, and he was furiously tweeting to Fox News saying, "It wasn't me." We also know that the connection between Adam Lanza's mother and the school was reported that she'd been a teacher or a teacher's assistant or a volunteer. She has no connection with the school. Now, this particular article I'm looking at is blaming people on social media. But that was picked up and reported broadly. And it's the media outlets that need to hold themselves to higher standards. The ages of the victims were screwed up. How the gunman entered the school. Some people said that the principal unlocked the door. Others reported that he broke down a door. There was a completely fabricated statement attributed to Morgan Freeman that was up on the web. He said he made no statement. There was also, as I mentioned yesterday, a report of a second shooter. That's been dropped, and I've seen no follow-up on it. And that the Bushmaster semi-automatic was found in the car, even though the coroner said that most of the young people killed died from that .22 caliber semi-automatic. And very little attention is being paid to the fact that 10 girls between the ages of 9 and 11 were killed on Monday. That's because it happened in Afghanistan. These girls were collecting firewood when reportedly a roadside bomb exploded. 11 girls. But they don't go to school in Connecticut. Their parents don't have SUVs. And the corporate media, not too interested. In Egypt over the weekend, they held the referendum over the new constitution. You know, there's been quite a bit of controversy over that and protest. Only about a third of eligible voters, 32%, showed up to vote. And there's more voting coming up in the hinterlands in 17 provinces this coming Saturday. So we won't know the result until probably around New Year's. Maybe before. And it's hard to read the low turnout. Are they rejecting participation altogether? Rejecting Morsi's power grab, which he's since backed down from? At least most of it. Or is it an anti-Islamist vote? Well, we'll have to sort that out later and see. An election was held in Japan on Sunday, creating a landslide victory for the so-called Liberal Democratic Party. Those are the conservatives in Japan. They were in power for ages and then lost to the opposition, the Democratic Party of Japan. Not to be confused with the Liberal Democratic Party, which is conservative, okay? And I'm sorry to confuse you, but that's the terminology they use. And Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda took a huge drubbing at the polls. And while there's certainly many issues in play, and I don't presume to second-guess the Japanese people, if we look at this narrowly on the issue of nuclear power and response to the Fukushima tsunami and meltdown, there's a huge setback for the anti-nuke forces. And that is quite disappointing. People have been taking to the streets in Moscow, but in fewer numbers because of the massive crackdown by Vladimir Putin and his forces. And despite that, on Saturday, about 2,000 demonstrators gathered outside the old KGB building. It's now called the FSB. It's in Lubyanka Square, not far from the Kremlin. And the police arrested dozens of people. Apparently, there were more cops than protesters. And one of the central figures is Alexei Navalny. And he was arrested on that scene. He is also fighting other charges that the government has brought against him for his leadership in protests a year ago, December, after the parliamentary elections that many people objected to, didn't think that they were legitimate. To its credit, the New York Times has a lengthy and powerful story about Walmart in the paper today. You can find it on their website, too. And they detail some of the bribes that Walmart de Mexico, or it would be de Mexico, paid out in order to overcome local opposition to the siting of various stores. And they talk about one site, which was an alfalfa field owned by Elda Pineda. And for a $52,000 bribe, they were able to bulldoze not only her alfalfa field, but also the planning process, the zoning process, which had clearly prohibited commercial development on her field. But Walmart wanted it. They shelled out $52,000 and managed to change the map before it was published, built the store, opened it in time for Christmas 2004. And they detail other examples. The Sam's Club in Mexico City, built in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Mexico City near the Basilica de Guadalupe. They built it without a construction license or an environmental permit or an urban impact assessment or a traffic permit, and greased the process with $341,000 in bribes. Be very interesting to see. I mean, this just begs for enforcement action. Will the Obama administration stand down from its let's look forward, not backward mantra and actually prosecute this clear wrongdoing? We'll see. In Afghanistan, we talked last week with Tamim Ansari, who has a new book out about his native land. He left when he was 16. And one of the things we talked about is how money is pouring in from the United States and often pours right back out. And last weekend, the New York Times reported on a spate of incidents discovered as couriers on airline flights climb on carrying bars of gold. And in one incident, where they intercepted a courier. This courier was carrying gold worth $1.5 million. And it's legal to fly it in and out of the country. Last year, Afghanistan Central Bank says roughly $4.5 billion in cash was spirited out of the country through the airport. And the amount of gold flying out of the country is way more than anybody thinks is actually in Afghanistan. And that's our money, friends. Much of it is. I want to thank Jason Ferguson, a listener, who posted on Facebook a link to an article in The Economist. And this follows up an item we mentioned last week about Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, who is fighting the FAA to change its archaic regulations to allow us to use phones and computers and other electronic gizmos on airline flights at all times. And this Economist column is from a blog called Babbage. And it goes into detail about studies that have been conducted regarding the potential for interference between portable electronic devices used by passengers and the electronics in the cockpit used to navigate the plane. And they report there are dozens of anecdotal reports of instruments on the flight deck being affected by passengers using portable electronic devices. Unfortunately, duplicating these under controlled conditions has proved nigh on impossible. Both Airbus and Boeing have bombarded their aircraft with electromagnetic radiation at frequencies and power levels used by mobile phones, only to come away empty-handed. In practice, then, the chance of unintentional transmitters doing any harm is infinitesimal. Indeed, that is just as well because flight crews have had permission from the FAA to use portable computers and iPads and other tablets in the cockpit since before tablets were invented, back in the early 1990s. Maybe someday we'll get rational about that. But it will have to start at the airport, won't it? Where we have to dismantle the TSA. And the security theater that we have to endure each time we want to get on a flight. And I'm going to post a link to this blog that I have just discovered. It's been around for a while. It's tsanewsblog.com. Unnamed journalists manage this site. And they post news about the oversteps of TSA. And here's the latest. From the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport, a 12-year-old girl in a wheelchair, Shelby Walzer, was moving through the checkpoint. She was traveling with her mother for medical treatment, again in a wheelchair. And she was detained there for more than an hour. Apparently, they used one of those swab things on the daughter, a chemical swab. And something showed positive. Something that could have been bomb-making residue. And so they called in a bomb specialist. Agents separated the crying 12-year-old from her mother for the full hour. And treated her like a criminal, like a terrorist. Does anybody have any common sense? And finally today, I want to thank David Spark, who sends me emails all the time. He is a digital media consultant here in San Francisco. And he published a list compiled by Joy Powers of the funniest tweets of 2012. A couple of samples. I can't believe I have to watch a 2-minute commercial on YouTube just to see a 9-second clip of a cat farting. Here's one, somebody named Pauly Pelagroso, which is Spanish for dangerous, posted, getting a gun rack installed in my car to hold all my burritos while I drive. I try to do the Twitter thing. I post there occasionally. But I don't go to Twitter and read many of the posts. I just don't find it that interesting. Here is Aspersion Cast. My bedroom is perfect for a one-night stand, but there's no room for two nightstands. A couple more? Can you handle it? Guys, check out my Facebook page today. I just uploaded 17,000 pictures of myself. Okay, one more. No, that one's kind of crude. Here's the final one from Matt Koff. I keep most of my chest hair on my back. Tweet at your own risk. Follow me on Twitter at even greater risk. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.